Welcome to the Night Watchman podcast, brought to you in association with Rathbones. I'm John Houghton. There are, as the cliche goes, no secrets in world cricket. The cameras, the ball tracking technology, the analysis, the live streams and the online commentary leaves no hiding place on the field. You can't even graze at fine leg for a few uneventful pre-tee overs anymore, lest someone like Joss Butler reverse ramp one straight at your head. There is comment, expert and otherwise, all over every media and social media outlet. Perhaps in response, players and teams have attempted to control the message with their own Insta videos and Amazon docu-series, peeling away the curtain even further, albeit in the most sanitised way. But there is one place that remains sacred and secret, and that's the selection room. Sure, we may hear afterwards a made-for-the-media version of a decision or outcome, but as to what is talked about and how it's said, how brutal or not it may be, the selection room remains the final frontier, a closed door. Ed Smith has led a remarkable life in and out of cricket. Son of the novelist Jonathan Smith, he glided through Cambridge, making a century on his first-class debut for the university and achieving a double first, before going on to play for Kent and later captain Middlesex, making 12,000 first-class runs and 34 hundreds. In 2003, he hit 6 centuries in the month of July and broke into the England Test side, making 64 on his debut. His diary of that season, on and off the field, became an award-winning book, and he is also written on baseball through a cricketing lens, in Playing Hardball, and intriguingly, on the nature of luck, in luck. In 2018, he put a successful career in academia and broadcasting on ice to become England's national selector, a 3-year term characterised by some epic England victories and bold selections that inevitably turned the focus onto the man making the choices. Now Ed has reflected on those 3 years in what is, I have to say, a fascinating new book that goes as far as anyone ever has into the selection process, and beyond that, into what makes humans take the decisions that they do. I urge everyone to read it, and I'm delighted to say that Ed joins us now. Ed, having queued you up as some sort of Superman, I wondered if you could first of all do the impossible and take us inside a selection meeting. Who's in the room and how does the conversation start? Paint us a picture.
John, it's great to be on the podcast, and thank you for that incredibly kind introduction. All it's left for me to do is to stuff it up now that you've set me up so generously. So, Dallas, everyone will be revising their opinions southwards. Look, I think the selection room is interesting, and actually you make a very interesting point that television has been ever hungrier about access. And exactly as you say, players are more and more available, but doesn't necessarily mean we know them better. And actually, in writing about selection, you also tread a careful path because something should remain confidential. And, but also I think there is a way of writing about selection which can illuminate the ideas. And my book is a book of ideas, which is so anchored in the real world, decisions that actually were made. The book's called Making Decisions. It explores the frameworks and ideas that I think that helped me, us, I hope, and England cricket. And each chapter kind of culminates in a decision. In terms of the room itself, in some ways, even though we often follow the consistent process, and process is a word we'll probably come back to later on,
yeah.
No two meetings are the same, and nor should they be exactly the same. Some things should be consistent and reliable and fair. But also there should be room for individuals to express themselves in a unique way. And in some ways, you want every meeting to be fresh and original. So in terms of if the question the book asks is, how might we make decisions better? Hopefully, if you're writing a book about making decisions, you hope it would be useful. One of the things is that the way you arrive at the point of making the decision is also very important. Are you open-minded? I'd be feeling curious and alert to new possibilities rather than defensive and jaded and exhausted. They're also very important things. So within the rhythm of a very demanding international schedule where everyone is constantly on the roller coaster of winning and losing, I think one of the jobs facing all selectors is how can they bring about the most interesting and useful conversation in those meetings. And I think significantly, though there are scientific strands to that, I think that's predominantly an art rather than science.
Well, that's what's fascinating about, certainly about the start of the book, isn't it? Where you immediately begin to assess the nature of a decision. The technical algorithm side of a decision, the data-driven side of a decision, and that more human side. Was that something you went into the job being aware of, that was the first reconciliation you would have to make?
Yes. And by the way, where I reach in the book took me an awfully long time to get to.
Did it? My idea
is about the relationship between what we might call human intelligence, which includes, obviously, imagination, intuition, and those areas which are quite hard to fully capture. You know, someone defined intuition as when we can't see our own working, which I think is quite a helpful framework.
Yeah.
You can't always perfectly explain something which is partly intuitive. And on the other hand, when I started as selector, yes, I had long been interested in the effective use of data in sport. I'd been in baseball. I'd followed the Moneyball revolution closely. I knew well Nathan Lehman, who is England's outstanding data analyst. And of course, you know, the optimist in me wants to think we can move at least towards something like optimizing selection. Where I ended up at was a rather different position, which is actually the value of the human being, the selector, who's a person, is precisely in those areas where you can't completely solve a problem. It's the weighing, reconciling, balancing different, sometimes competing forms of information, which is the human test, I think. So you start off trying to not quite solve, but, you know, with an optimistic, bit more scientific hat on. And over time, you realize that it's ultimately about making a judgment, I think.
Now, it's interesting that you kind of came back to cricket when you became the national selector. And I think there was I don't know how I'd describe it, you know, whether people still remembered you as a player, whether you still remembered yourself as a player, because obviously this was a process you would have certainly gone through at Middlesex when you were captain there. Yes. You would have been involved in selections and contract offers and so on. So how divorced did you feel? How much of a different person were you coming to the job the second time around?
Very different person. I would just, one thing probably just, I wouldn't have been involved in contract offers as a captain. I definitely had final say on selection. I actually found, you know, and there are areas of my captaincy that I'm critical of looking back. I think sometimes when I was a player, I was perceived as being a little bit distant, and I was quite critical of some aspects of my captaincy in that way. One area where I felt quite confident that I could make a positive contribution was as a selector when I was captain, because I'd always been interested in how teams could get better through selection right from a very young age. It had been, you know, we tend to stay close to the bits in professional sport where we think we can add value. One of the ways that I thought teams could quickly get better was through who was on the field. You know, typically sport had moved heavily investing towards coaching, but actually selection's the quicker fix in some respects, because it's obviously going to be a journey with a coach and a player. But actually, who's on the field is a risk decision. So, yes, I'd always been interested in selection, but in terms of your question, I was coming back as a very different person because I'd been out of the game for 10 years. I retired in 2008. I came back in 2018. And during those 10 years, even though I never knew what I was doing when I was writing articles and books and making programs, one of the things I was doing was exploring the question, how might you find an edge in professional sport today?
Yeah.
That gives those 10 years more coherence than they felt like they had at the time. But looking back on it, I think that was a big part of my interest in the decade after cricket as a player.
Yeah.
Unknown to me, they would come together as being the background context that informed some of the ways I looked at decision-making in cricket. So, for example, American sport as often had led in sports analytics. And, you know, it's very standard in American sport to look at a player's effect on net team performance, you know, plus, minus, wins against replacement, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Which is surprisingly lacking traditionally from the discourse in cricket, where people say, he averages 28 as a bowler, so how can you possibly leave him out and pick a player who averages 29 and a half? Well, the answer might be, because in the context of putting together a team bowling attack, which functions as a unit of five or six bowlers, variety brings the collective improvement, So there are times in cricket when the team dimension sheds a different light on selection rather than just an individual matchup of X v Y. So one of the ways I looked at selection in cricket was, what does the team need? And I think we thought very long and hard about that. And I hope, you know, we made a contribution by doing that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things to pick up on in that. But one name that cropped up in the book that I was immediately interested in, because I've read his book, was Daniel Kahneman, who you refer to, who wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, which I think is, you know, for a layman like me and many other people, is absolutely revelatory about human decision making, especially as pertains to sport, in when he describes the availability heuristic of you know, all of us recalling the most recent piece of information and making a decision based on that. And I wondered how much of that sort of broad-based thinking, first of all, you were using, and secondly, that you were explaining to people that you were using, and how it worked as a tool. Did you sort of internalize all this, or did you go out and to your, you know, you mentioned obviously Mo Bobat, who you work closely with, and Nathan and James Taylor, all very different people, and you factor the captain into that, and everyone else you're speaking to. It just struck me as there's a bit of a leap there, but the concepts themselves are incredibly interesting and incredibly useful to people who have to help you make decisions. And I wondered how you approached that.
Well, it's a good question. I interviewed Daniel Kahneman, I think, in 2010.
Did you? Wow.
And it was a very interesting it was The Spectator who sent me to interview him. And, you know, to some degree, writing luck had led me to that, you know, area as well. And I'd got to know Nassim Taleb, who'd obviously written Fooled by Randomness. All of which raises the question of flaws in human judgment, which of course has become a central part of the field that we now, you know, nervous behavioral economics. Now, I think that my time as selector, we did draw on some of those frameworks, and I think they proved useful and helpful at times. When you talk about the recency bias there, that, you know, if you have a selection meeting at the end of the season and several people say, oh, how about this guy from X county? And he gets 200s at the end of the season, but they don't talk about the guy that gets 500s at the start of the season. It's a fair question to say, hang on a minute, you know, we're reviewing the whole body of work, not just what happened last week. However, I don't follow behavioral economics absolutely all the way, because I do think that there is still a role for human judgment. And one of the central arguments of the book is that I don't think it's fair to say that just because someone admits it's a judgment, that that's necessarily, you know, problematic or leads to a bias or a flaw. Because I think that many areas of life cannot be turned into an exact science. And indeed, many areas of life, you're not going to get enough data for it to be perfectly robust. You know, you can't necessarily get the same two players to have the same sets of experiences that leads to a perfectly fair comparison of their form in certain forms of cricket. There aren't enough games to go around in county cricket played against test quality bowlers, for example. So in that gap where the data is insufficient and you don't know for sure, that's where your value is. That's where you have to if you like, be better than the next person or better than the average. So I suppose, again, there's two parts to this point. One is, yes, learning from, if you like, people who've successfully identified ways in which human judgment often errs, but also not losing all confidence that human beings can still add value without it being a perfectly robust scientific experiment. Because I do think that some people do have better judgment than others.
Yeah,
and I think we see over time that some sports teams are, the decision making is better than others. And that's not always about data.
Well, I mean, cricket, and I suppose you would say sport generally, I'm maybe not including baseball in this, but is it fair to say there's a kind of slightly anti-intellectual bent where a concept like intuition might mean something different to a player than it does to a behavioural scientist? And I wondered how you coped with that when you were trying to communicate what you wanted to do.
Well, first of all, and I probably didn't answer your last question completely, I think you have lots of different types of conversations, don't you, when you're in a decision-making role. And you try and get the best information from all the people you're talking to. And that will be done in a different style. Some people like very structured, formal meetings. Some people like to chat, and they've got great information if you can fall in step with them on the training ground and just chat and walk, and it can be light and doesn't have to be everyone sitting with their back straight in a formal meeting going through an agenda. So I think that's part of just being someone who's moving in the real. I think to some extent that the term data in sport is almost part of a culture war, where to people who think it's all about data, they are sometimes closed to the great value that exists in other areas of sporting wisdom. And for people who don't like data, they think that everything that goes wrong or looks unconventional should be put four squarely at the door of those data geeks have stuffed it up again by being too clever by half.
Yeah.
So I have a more rounded view that data is one very useful input into a decision-making system or framework or approach, along with lots of others. So let's bring this back to the particular England cricket. We had a very good data team. We also had very good scouts, which is different. You know, scouts watch and look and judge, but it's obviously not the same as, averages and numbers. Even though you might aggregate their wisdom, they're still human beings watching and forming a judgment of a player. And then, of course, you want to find out what the coach and the captain think of the inside view. But then, of course, you want to protect your independence and the fact that you're not completely in that conversation, which is in the dressing room all the time, because part of your value, I think, as a selector is that you stand a little bit removed from that. So in amongst those four or five inputs, you then have to weigh and reconcile and form a total picture. So I don't think data, in my experience, I've very rarely seen it be the total answer. I've often seen it be a useful input into the decision-making process.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the point you identify, that we don't have to pick sides here. Just because you say there's value in, let's call it pioneering sports data, that there are people who are doing new work in data analytics, which is extremely useful. Just because you believe that doesn't mean you don't believe there is merit in feel and intuition and the wisdom of a great cricket person. There is. You've got to bring them together and get the best out of both.
Yeah. To touch kind of on an area of that intuition, and that, I suppose, you would say is broadly aesthetics, how someone looks when they play the game. you might guess the name I'm going to come on to here. I'll throw in as an example, James Vince.
Well, I knew I was going to get about James Vince from the old batsman.
Yeah, but you know, but there also strikes me there's another example of someone you were working very closely with in James Taylor as well, and his career, which was always kind of shaped by the way he looked, because he was, you know, a shorter guy. You know, people take these judgments, don't they, in the way that people look. And how do you break through that?
Well, I think that's where data can be very useful, actually. So, you know, let's take James Taylor. Of the two Jameses you mentioned, yes, we'll start with James Taylor. So James had to overperform to get recognition. You know, I'm making it up, but whether he had to get 3 runs for every 2 the next person did, all the way up.
Yeah,
there was always someone who's kind of, you know, 6'2" and got a nice off drive, and that's not James Taylor. He was very short. I remember commentators saying to me when he first played for England in 2012, you know, he's far too short, any format, whatever, it's not going to work. And I said, I don't agree with that. You know, a lot of great batsmen have actually been shorter rather than taller. Sonny Gavaskar, you know, Sachin Tendulkar, even Brian Lara, not 5'4", but on the shorter side. So, you know, now James therefore comes from a background, you know, his experience is you've got to get it done. You've got to perform. You've got to get the run. Show me the end column. Now, actually, my sort of framing or the way I tended to view the game was a little bit more towards how will it translate? So, you know, when I'm watching, you know, players who are under consideration, I'm always thinking about the higher percentage of faster bowling, higher percentage of high quality spin, different conditions. We're talking here about test cricket, you know, which is probably the hardest judgment, because county cricket is a bigger gap to test cricket rather than IPL cricket, for example, is to the T20s internationally. So test cricket is always hard, particularly given our system with lots of counties and difficult pitches and all the rest of it. So I think James and I were quite a good pairing, because we were complementary and we viewed the game through slightly different lenses, but with a lot of trust personally. So we, you know, we would argue and disagree, but always protecting confidences and no leaks, and always coming to a united position at the end. I don't think I ever heard anyone say, "Oh, you know, James thinks this, but Ed thinks that," or "Ed thinks this, but James thinks the opposite."
Yeah.
But of course, if you've been in the room with us, you know, it wouldn't have taken 5 minutes before you realised that was happening all the time. So I think that's an example. Actually, James suffered from, you know, to use the economics term, he suffered from biases all the time in his playing career. People said he's too short. Of course, he ended up getting a lot of runs and going past a lot of people who were picked before him.
Yeah.
So I think the question of, and obviously this insight, if you can call it that, is one of the foundation stones of Moneyball, which is that Billy Beane, who's the general manager of the Oakland Athletics, and the architect of the actual decision making, which Michael Lewis writes up very well in Moneyball, he himself had been a very talented, handsome, young professional athlete.
Yeah.
And everyone had wanted to believe that, therefore, it was extremely likely eventually his talent would come to the fore and he'd fulfill himself. And Billy Beane's insight is, but I never did. So they overestimated me. And I'm not going to make the same mistake with other people. So he looks for the misfits. He looks for the people who don't look the part but get the job done. A very interesting insight there is, you know, can you find hidden value by looking in places that other people don't look? One of the exercises I once asked our data and scouting team to look at was, what would be the best performing 11 in county cricket you could pick among people, open quote, who England would never pick?
Wow.
In other words, all the guys who were too old, overweight, difficult, whatever it was. And of course, it's not that you're going to pick those guys necessarily, but it forces you in doing that exercise to confront what it is about these types of players that you're not looking for, or that leads you to believe that they're not the answer. Maybe you need to actually revisit some of those things. And of course, we can all think of examples where allowances are made for really great players who have some of those characteristics, whether it's their body shape or their personality or whatever. But players who aren't quite as good get written off because of it. And that's a very interesting question. At what point do you tolerate something or a characteristic which is unusual?
Yeah.
If it adds up to a net value to the team.
Yeah. I suppose what would, you know, and you successfully evaded talking about James Vince there, which I will let you off. There are players.
We talk about James.
There are players, and I suppose he might fall into this category. I think. Which are probably the hardest to deal with, are the ones where the gap between their very best and their average is quite wide. And you might put a player like Zach Crawley into that category as well, where you get an average performance, I mean average as in a mean average, and then you get this huge spike to what their absolute best is. And the key to their success would be somehow closing that gap. And I wondered how you approach that as opposed to selecting a consistent player. You know, I remember asking Nathan Lehman once, is it better to have a guy who scores 0-0-0-100 than 0-50, you know, 40-30? It was quite hard to solve that statistically. So I wondered how you approach that kind of player.
Well, let's not dodge the James Vince any longer.
Great.
Everyone loves reading. Reading John Houghton on James Vince. So, first of all, it's a very interesting question. I mean, James is a beautiful player and a wonderful striker of the ball. And, you know, some people think he should have had more opportunities than he has had. And if he were to come back strongly into international cricket with England and do well, you know, I'd be the first person to be pleased about that because we all love watching him play. So the question there is, you know, is one of opportunity, and do you keep going with someone who's had a certain amount of opportunity, a decent amount of opportunity, and not quite shown his very best, or do you go somewhere else? And that's a very difficult judgment because, you know, there have been examples in sport where a national team has persisted with someone who had very high potential, despite the fact it was on relatively limited evidence. And Laurie Saul, as chairman of selectors, stuck with Steve Waugh for a long time. Yeah. And of course, the returns were fantastic for Australia. So you can always make the case that if you'd persevered with a player, they would have had that breakthrough moment where they felt completely at home and then everything flowed easily. So that's a fair perspective. And perhaps James Vince will come back and have that flowering and play in his brilliant style and an England shirt more often, and everyone will be pleased. In terms of, you know, how would you choose to break down, if you like, the same number of runs and the same number of innings? Very interesting question you asked Nathan Lehman. The same point was made to me by John Inverarity, the brilliant coach and captain of Western Australia, national selector for Australia, who took Australia to first in the three formats. And when he was a coach at Warwickshire, I think it was 2002, Jonathan Trott got a pretty good amount of runs, let's say 1,200 runs over the season, an average of, say, 45 or 50, but with relatively few hundreds. Off the top of my head, I think he had 10 50s and a couple of hundreds. And I'd got a very similar amount of runs for Kent, but I mean, maybe it was 2004, I can't remember, but with more hundreds and fewer 50. Now, conventionally in cricket, people tend to say bad conversion rate, not turning 50s into 100s. But John Inverarity said, would you have it any other way? 50 every time from your number three sounds pretty good to me, he said, if I'm head coach.
Yeah.
Interesting point. So, yeah, really, the question of high volatility with high peaks but low troughs, or but more consistency. If it's the same number of runs, I'd be interested to see whether someone can actually statistically say which is better and which is worse. I'm not clear. I actually tend to think that John Inverarity had a point, and particularly in your top order players, consistency would have value. The other point that's probably a little bit missing in the analysis of Zach Crawley, certainly this summer when Zach Crawley's place in the England team became one of those talking points that generates dozens and dozens of columns and hours of commentary. is what's the expected return of the alternative? Now, this is pretty fundamental. So I commentated on lots of England games before becoming a selector, and then I selected for a while, and obviously I've kept an interest after being selected. Now, since 2012, England have tried more than a dozen opening batsmen. And if you lined up all the averages of those opening batsmen in a row, you'd probably find the median average was something like 24.
Yeah.
So it goes, you know, 17, 28, 19, 22, 23, 27, 21. So when someone is having a difficult spell, whether that be Keaton Jennings, who's come back into the England team today, England squad today, or Joe Denley, or this summer Zach Crawley, there's a clamour to drop them. And people often frame it as England can't go on tolerating one or two or three who averages 27 or 29 or 30, whatever it is. To which the answer is, well, they can go on if they think it's still the best option for the team. You should only change a team when you think you're improving it.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the great sayings of Nathan Lehman is, a bad team can always be made worse through selection, and a good team can always be made better. I would tend to the view that people are too ready to change a team that's struggling and too reluctant to change a team that's doing well. What you should really be doing is just trying to improve the team if you can. And if you can't, you obviously leave it as it is. So I think it frustrates me as a viewer and now, if you like, a consumer of cricket
news,
that the context around top order batting is often missed. I thought Rob Key made a really good point when he pointed out that David Warner averaged 9, I think, in the 2019 Ashes at home. And I watched some of that series with the Australian selectors. And, you know, they're seeing their team collapse. I'm seeing every top order doing what every top order done in 2018 and 2019, which is finding extremely difficult against the Duke ball in England.
Yeah.
Whether that was Pakistan in 2018, India in 2018, England in 2018, 2019, or Australia in 2019. It was extremely difficult batting. Now, opposition teams normally chopped and changed their top order more. So Australia sort of burned through, you know, Harris, Khawaja, and England typically stuck with those players more. You know, we persevered with, you know, whether it was Keaton Jennings through the difficult summer of 2018, and then he had a fantastic spell in Sri Lanka after that, or whether it was Rory Burns and Joe Denley, who held up really well against world-class bowling in 2019.
Yeah.
So I think the context and understanding of what's reasonable expectation can help you to make better decisions.
Yeah. The Night Watchman podcast is brought to you by Rathbones Investment Management for individuals, charities and financial advisors. We couldn't do it without them, so please head over to rathbones.com to find out more about what they can do for you. One of the really most striking moments in the book, and an example of data absolutely doing its job, is the passage about Jofra Archer and when you bring him into the one day side, and you write really brilliantly about how the data tells you that with Jofra Archer, you know, not only should he be in the squad, he should be in the team, and not only is he in the team, he will be the best bowler, and not only will he be the best bowler for England, he will be the best bowler in the tournament. And the data actually tells you this before it happens, and it of course goes on to happen in the most extraordinary fashion. And I wondered how you felt seeing something like that come to life.
Look, you framed the question very well. I'm not sure we got quite as far as predicting he'd be the best player in the tournament, best bowler tournament. The difference between Jofra Archer, and of course it culminates in that moment when, you know, the World Cup's in his hands, and, you know, Jofra being Jofra, he gets his decisions right, and Owen Morgan gets his conversations right, and Josh Butler breaks the stumps and the World Cup is won, and, you know, in that incredible, unpredictable day at Lord's. I think with Jofra, his career was very unusual because the early part of his career had been played out on a big stage significantly in franchise competitions that are televised. And televised cricket, which demands Hawkeye technology, which demands multiple high-definition cameras, has the unintended consequence of providing very rich data that ends up in the hands of people like me who go, thank you very much. How fast is every ball? How many revolutions on every ball? What's the trajectory of every ball? What's the bounce of every ball? So you get an X-ray picture of the game, you know, as it's played, rather than relying on impressions or perceptions. And what we saw from that data was that Jofra was absolutely exceptional. Of course, we also saw that with our own eyes as well. But we knew with an unusual degree of confidence that Jofra was exceptional. So, but that was, and I think you very rightly point out that that was at the extreme end of very good information.
Yeah.
Normally, you don't have that quality of information. For example, you know, if you are looking at picking a county batsman from four-day cricket into the test team, we know for a fact that those two formats are very different. You know, that's the only red ball cricket they're likely to have played, perhaps a Lions game here or there. They won't have played as an overseas player on hard bouncy pitches and against a Kookaburra ball. And we know that in county cricket, there's much less world-class spin. You know, spinners take fewer wickets proportionally than in test cricket. We know that there's much less fast bowling. We know there are many fewer bouncers bowled. So there are all sorts of ways in which test cricket is a very different game from four-day cricket in England. And the two games have drifted apart, sadly, in the last 15 years. Much more different, I think, than in the era when I played, when most people that came into the England team, and to some degree I'm the worst possible person to make this argument because, you know, I came in, failed and exited very quickly. But most people that came into the England team in my era had very similar first-class averages, county averages, to test averages, whether that's Andrew Strauss or Paul Collingwood or Jonathan Trott or Matthew Prior. If you average 40 in county cricket, most of them average 40-ish in test cricket, and they're very good players. So, in the case of picking a young county batsman, you know, from four-day cricket into test cricket, there's a lot you don't know. How are they going to go against sustained, hostile, fast bowling from both ends all through the day? If you like, think about one of the most brilliant days cricket of the whole 3 years when I was selector was day three at Headingley in what became Ben Stokes's match against Australia. One of the things that happened in day three, first of all, was that Joe Root and Joe Denley bat for a very long time against incredible bowling. Now, I've very rarely seen a bowling attack that scarcely missed all day. You know, it was just each spell from an Australian fast bowler began with sort of hard length just outside off stump, and they just did it time and time and time again.
Yeah.
And England batted extremely well to soak up that pressure and absorb that pressure. And over the course of that day, you could sort of see Australia getting a little bit tired. And the next day, you know, no one could have predicted the way it worked out with Ben Stokes. But obviously that day, day four, is impossible without day three. Now, how would someone who's, you know, only ever played county cricket have fared in that context against, you know, Cummins and Hazelwood? It's extremely difficult to know. It's much easier to be confident, how's Jofra Archer going to bowl in the World Cup? Because you've seen him bowl against similar level players in similar pressure situations in the IPL where there's abundant data. And you can see that he's one of the very best, if not the best in the world.
And I mean, you must have, after that day at Lord's, I mean, I don't know if you slept, but you must have gone home and reflected on, you know, just the extraordinary nature of the last hour of the game. I mean, there were things in that that no one could ever have predicted happening. That happened, and obviously you'd written an entire book about luck. I just wondered how you think, you know, that played into everything.
Well, of course, you know, and Simon Cooper had the line in the FT when he said the last, you know, the World Cup final basically proved, you know, the whole thesis of Ed's book. You know, if you're interested in chance and randomness, then some of those events obviously were absolutely at the extreme end of unpredictable.
Yeah.
And they kept happening as well. Even, you know, right down to the super over with, you know, the shot for six, the wide, which possibly isn't a wide, the perfect Yorker that could have been called okay, but it's called wide. All these things are right on the margin. You know, the catch that then leads to a six, you know, all these things, the misfield, then the run out. So it was actually an extraordinary match. And it shows a wider point, doesn't it? That on any given day, there is always a high degree of exposure, even in a sport which is as long and thorough as cricket, there's always a high degree of exposure to luck and randomness. Over the course of a season or a longer spell, I think that's where the best team typically does come to the top.
Yeah.
And that's why there's a distinction, isn't there, between leagues and rankings, which I think are probably more just and fair, and tournaments where, you know, a great team or a very, very good team can have a fantastic regular season in American sport, they would use that expression, and then lose in the playoffs. Happened to the New York Mets just a few days ago. They had 100+ wins in the regular season and got swept in the playoffs straight away, and they're out. And that was an argument that Billy Beane used to use about Oakland's relative failure to sort of go all the way in World Series baseball, was that it's not enough games to know if the best team won a best of seven series in baseball. So I think you have to accept that in something like a World Cup, you might have the best team, you might play the best cricket, and you're not necessarily going to win. But I think in terms of the world rankings, or if you like, a sustained period of time, that's probably a fairer assessment of how well you did. You know, the wins and losses column over the course of a long, you know, 2 or 3 year spell.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I suppose the other great sort of deus ex machina that happened to you. And
I've never been confident about that phrase. So no, I'm glad you said it, not me. Look,
I sort of think it might work in this context, just in that COVID came along, and that's something that you know, no one outside of sort of Stephen King or whatever could ever have predicted. And yeah, it did. You write about it a little bit in the book, but I think it. You know, we probably still don't know what impact that had on the players who were, you know, needed to live in the bubble and all of the things that happened around that, and that kind of coincided with you coming to the end of your 3 years. Yes. And I just, you do a great job of saying you feel your time with England was complete and that it was time for it to finish. But it did have this kind of very strange period towards the end. And I wondered how you reflect on that.
An interesting question. I think what happens sometimes in sport is that a narrative grows where several different strands get rolled together and they seem close enough that perhaps there's, you know, from the casual onlooker's perspective, it all sounds a little bit the same. So in the case of COVID, one of the things that we had done in Test cricket was to focus a lot more on picking teams to win specifically overseas. England had a very, very difficult few years before I started on overseas tours, not just the Ashes, but also India, UAE against Pakistan, even in Bangladesh, it had been 1-1. So I think that had been the only test they'd won for a few years. So Test cricket abroad was proving very difficult. And we wanted to do things differently. So the first tour we had was Sri Lanka in 2018. We played three all-rounders, three spinners, which is typically not work for England, but it did in that context, and we won 3-0. And over the course of the whole 3 years, we actually won more games in Test cricket abroad than we lost, which is, you know, a significant upgrade, if you like. However, so there's a perception that England doing things differently, perhaps some people would say too clever by half or getting funky with selection or whatever, all those framings that people, some of us have for risk-taking or diverging from consensus. And then there's COVID, which we thought brought with it a necessity to give people some time outside biosecure environments. That is, those environments where they're not allowed to leave the hotel or cricket ground. So what we experienced in that first COVID summer at the Aegeus Bowl and in Old Trafford, when, you know, you kind of, you work at the cricket ground, you sleep at the cricket ground, you eat at the cricket ground, and that's what you do, yeah, nowhere else. And then you go to bed, and in the case of the Aegeus Bowl, there's a framed photograph of a cricket ball or a boundary rope in your hotel room just to remind you where you are.
Yeah.
So, you know, now after coming on for 18 months of that, you know, we were faced with players looking at 3 months straight in another biosecure bubble, having just had a, you know, an abandoned tour to South Africa, where England left early. The last set of selections I made was, you know, whether it was December, January 2020/2021, and England were facing a biosecure bubble in Sri Lanka and then a biosecure bubble in India 3 months straight. So if you're a multi-format player, you know, you're basically not going to be leaving the room for 3 months. We all felt, all of us involved in the decision-making process, that it wasn't fair to ask Ben Stokes, Jofra Archer, Mark Wood, Sam Curran, Joss Butler, Johnny Bairstow, these guys who play across formats, to do the whole thing. So we used a rotation policy to give them blocks of rest, and Moeen Ali as well, to give them blocks of rest across that period, which of course has difficult consequences because you're getting people in and out of tours with quarantine periods and convoluted travel arrangements. And oh my God, you know, whole months of my life disappear on red lists and green lists. And, you know, who knew whether the route to India went via Dubai was open or closed, or all these things. You know, I sort of felt I was part of a travel agency for a while, a mixture of kind of Foreign Office advisory and travel agent, which wasn't something that I necessarily anticipated becoming selected, but nor did any of the coaches or administrators. So everyone was in the same boat. Now, here's the point. You know, England decide to kind of protect and look after those players so that they stay sane, and also so we believe the team keeps winning, and we also believe it's the best thing for the team. Results turn in the middle of that India tour. So we've won the two tests in Sri Lanka, the first test in India, then we lose the next three. People are coming and going. There's a wider at the back of the memory sense that, well, don't these guys do some interesting things with selection? Are they all getting a bit too complicated? And it all gets jumbled together in a general narrative. It's rotation policy that ruined everything.
Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, that analysis doesn't survive very much critical thinking. But I think it was there, and I think it was part of the kind of the story at the beginning of 2021, and then selections is abolished, and that was that. I'm not saying the one directly led to the other, but it was part of that atmosphere. So what do you learn? You learn that sometimes a narrative can be quite strongly entrenched, which needs to be disentangled and separated. And of course, I blame myself, because if you're a decision maker, part of your job is to communicate not only internally, but also externally, and to make these points clearly. And obviously I didn't do that well enough. So I think, you know, I think COVID was tricky for everyone. It wasn't just tricky for selectors, it was tricky for players, administrators, everyone was kind of stretched.
Yeah. So as a final question, you've had this little period away from the game now. I mean, as we've seen, many other opportunities and directions that your life could take, but do you ever see it intersecting with cricket again?
You know, I never really have a position on the future. You know, I'm maybe perceived as being quite, you know, understated, or I don't sort of reveal my cards that much, but I'm actually very instinctive and very spontaneous, and I do what I want to do, really. I've never had a career plan. I've never known what the future holds or wanted to know. And actually, one of the points that I felt when I was writing Luck was that, you know, part of my cricket career had sort of opened me up to the idea that it was not knowing what was going to happen that was one of the things that made life so interesting. So in a sense, I've stayed close to that. I never sought or wanted to be, had a selection for England cricket. It came around. I found it very interesting, very engaging challenge, brilliant colleagues, but it wasn't something I sought. And in the same way, now that I'm back, you know, living with ideas and writing and working in academia with my Institute of Sports Humanities, which is opening up in other territories as well as here in the UK, you know, I'm not currently thinking about coming back into high performance sport, whether that's cricket or anything else. The only thing I'd say on the other side of it is that there isn't anything exactly like team sport, because, you know, much as I like the idea, eventually I'll grow up and, you know, be a sort of serious human being. There's still that that child inside me, which I think needs to be there in anyone who's involved in sport, which just wants to win and have that elation of the game. And even though we know that a sports result doesn't necessarily bring perfect justice, when you win, yeah, it feels that way. When you lose, you've always got the consolation that it's not fair. And there's nothing like the highs and the sense of shared mission that comes with being part of a team project. And I used to joke with my friends I worked with at Royal Challengers Bangalore in 2016 that if it hadn't have been for re-engaging with cricket at that IPL and watching Virat Kohli and AB de Villiers redefine the, what could be done with the cricket bat before my eyes, I probably never would have, you know, been in a place where I could have accepted or done the England selector role, because I wouldn't have been, I wouldn't have had a recent set of experiences in performance sport. So here I am now. Normally what happens is I say, I'm not going to do that again. And then one day the phone rings and you make the mistake of answering it. And then having answered it, you make the mistake of listening to the person on the other end. And then you think about it and you find yourself getting excited again. And then you remember you're just a child and you've never really moved on at all. So never rule out the prospect that sport's still got a hold over us, which we can't shake and perhaps don't want to. It reminds me of the last line of Jim Bouton's brilliant book about baseball, Ball Four, which was the first, whether it was published in 1969, I think, he'd pitched for the Yankees. And it was one of the first great diaries, you know, when exposés didn't really happen. And, you know, ball players, as they say in America, were supposed to be these saintly figures that, you know, drank milk and went to bed early. And not always like that. And I think the last line in the book is, you spend your life thinking you're holding a baseball and then you realize the baseball's holding you. And, you know, you've probably heard my voice breaking up a little bit there because I'm thinking about cricket and, and my relationship with cricket. And you realize there's something very deep inside you. And this has got, you know, this shows you how far we've come in this conversation from data and weighted averages and algorithms. We're talking about love and we're talking about identity and we're talking about belonging and friendship and fun and creativity. And all those ties that bind us to our community and our friends and our family. You know, my father, who was, as you said in your introduction, you know, a novelist and a sensitive person, not a, you know, elite sportsman, but loved cricket, loved its ambience, its subtlety, its friendships, its stories. And I grew up talking to him about cricket, still talk to him today. And maybe that's part of what I love about the game. Maybe it's partly about, you know, an extension or maybe it's deepened by the relationship between, you know, father and a son. My son plays cricket. My daughter plays cricket. So these things, they've got nothing to do with calculating job opportunities or working out, you know, maximizing careers or whatever. It's just who you are and what you love, and who knows how that manifests itself as decision making or choices. And I think you learn to trust about your own life. You learn to listen to, certainly, your inner voice. And when you sense that you care and when you sense that you are engaged, you should probably do it. Philip Larkin probably put it a lot more
simply than that. Ed, you put it perfectly. Thank you so much. That was brilliant. Thanks to Ed Smith, whose new book, Making Decisions, is out now. Thanks for listening. The Night Watchman podcast is written and presented by me, John Houghton, produced by James Wallace, and brought to you in association with Rathbones. The new series is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed it, then do spread the word, subscribe, and maybe even leave us a review.